I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. 10 years ago, two undergrads from Yale noticed the fundamental gap between their university and the community that surrounds it. To bridge this divide, they formed the volunteer training organization now known as LIFT. We'll speak with Ben Ruler, the executive director of LIFT Chicago, about harnessing the energy of students to engage them in community and help fight poverty. And good design can do many things, but can it change the world? My guest, Warren Berger, has written a book on how design is doing just that. His book, Glimmer, shows how design in action is addressing business, social, and personal challenges and improving the way we think, work, and live. All that, plus the latest news from Planet Edison and our City Views commentator, Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City. I have some news I want to share. After nearly 10 years of weekly Smart City shows, I think that's about 1,000 interviews I've done in that time, I'm going to continue doing interviews online, but not for broadcast. So you'll no longer be able to hear Smart City on your local public radio station, but I assure you we're not going away. We're going to continue to produce new content on our website, smartcityradio.com, and at ceosforcities.org. I'm excited by this change. We've appreciated our broadcast partners for Smart City, but we think the web offers us unlimited potential for long-form, uncut interviews, even some shorter interviews, as well as some video content. I hope you'll join me in making this transition, and while I'm sorry to go missing from your radio dial, I hope you'll continue to make room for me and for Smart City on your iPod. Thanks for listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. LIFT is an organization that trains and deploys student volunteers to combat poverty in their communities. Founded in New Haven, Connecticut, the organization now has 8 local branches where volunteers work one-on-one with people to create a personal pathway out of poverty. Ben Ruler is the executive director of LIFT Chicago. Ben, poverty is not a popular subject. We hear little about it from the White House, even Congress. Has finding solutions to poverty been left now to nonprofits?
That is a great question. What I can tell you is I think we at LIFT have figured out something cool and innovative to combat poverty and expand opportunity to all people in this country, because we're not okay with how things are right now. And we do envision a day where everybody can have the opportunity to achieve economic security. So I do think there's some great ideas coming from the nonprofit sector. And hopefully we can merge those with local government as well.
Explain how LIFT works.
Yeah, so I'm with LIFT, which is a growing movement to combat poverty and expand opportunity to everybody in this country. And the cool thing about LIFT is the way we do this. We do this by leveraging incredible college volunteers from our nation's campuses to come and volunteer in our resource centers. So if you came back with me after this interview to one of our local offices here in Chicago, for example, you would see college students who took the train into one of our offices and are sitting in front of a computer with a community member, likely somebody from a low to moderate income background, sitting in front of a computer working on goals relating to housing, employment, accessing public benefits. It's just a phenomenal model, very little red tape for our clients and the people we're serving. These college students are just phenomenal. They're tenacious. They're scavengers. They're impatient. They're coming in, rolling up their sleeves, ready to support the community. And they're getting so much out of this experience. They're going on after graduation to really further committed to careers and lives dedicated to service.
What attracts your volunteers to this work?
That is a great question. And to be honest, when I started with LIFT, I wondered, geez, this recruiting of college students must be a big ordeal. Like, that must be where a bulk of the time comes. To be honest, we actually have people apply to volunteer, and then we interview them. Right now, we don't even have the capacity to take on all the volunteers we want. And now we're, you know, in Chicago, for example, we're dealing with a couple university partners right now, Loyola University and Northwestern, both phenomenal campuses with great commitment to service. Recruiting college students to help fight poverty has been a non-issue. These folks are signing up by the droves. We go to organizational fairs at, you know, Loyola University, for example. We have a booth set up. We'll get 150 names of students interested in doing this. And I ask every one of them, why are you doing this? You're busy, you're swamped with schoolwork, you have a million extracurricular things going on. Why are you spending 5 hours out of your week coming in, oftentimes not getting credit, oftentimes not getting paid, not even work study, to volunteer in our resource centers? And 99% of the answers are just genuine, like, I love this, I feel like I'm making a difference, I'm getting to know my community, I see what's going on, I'm not okay with the inequity in this country, I want to make a difference, and I'm getting great professional development. None of these students are doing this to put something on their resume, they're doing it because they're committed to making a difference, and it just blows me away week in and week out, just thinking of the possibilities if we could scale this up in the cities we're in, like Chicago, if we could take this to tap into University of Illinois Chicago, University of Chicago, you know, DePaul, the city colleges. There's really no limit to what this sustainable volunteerism can do to combat poverty in our cities. And it's cost effective by leveraging these student advocates and working closely with the university partners. It's just a brilliant model, one that, you know, has proven to work for us over the last 10 years, and we're excited about growing even more.
Ben, what's the training like for these volunteers?
Yeah, great question. So every volunteer goes through what we call new volunteer training, which is often a 1 or 2 day pretty intensive training that goes over the basic tenets of client service. So strength-based programming, goal setting, confidentiality, you know, mandatory child abuse reporting, all those kind of basics of client service, client tracking notes. So this is the type of agenda items that are new volunteer trainings. And then these students, in addition to their 4 hours a week in our resource centers, are going to a weekly or every other weekly ongoing training that are issue specific. So we'll do maybe a training on resumes or online internet employment searches. We'll bring in guest speakers to talk about affordable housing or financial literacy or credit repair. And those types of ongoing trainings happen all the time because it's really important that our volunteers are well-trained and able to keep up with what's happening in the field. And also one thing we really train our volunteers, in addition to understanding all the great things they can do, is understanding what their limitations are as college volunteers. These folks are not coming in trying to pretend like they're therapists or, you know, doing any psychoanalysis or anything like that. We train people to work within the limitations of our model, and we've seen them just be able to thrive. And our clients love it. We have client feedback sessions and client advisory boards. Every time it's so powerful to be at these meetings because our clients are recognizing college students are positive, they're optimistic, they're managing smaller caseloads than most overwhelmed social workers and case managers in our communities. So they're really able to provide personalized, individualized services to these clients. And the feedback we hear from community members is overwhelmingly positive, and it's really cool to see.
How do your clients hear about LIFT?
Yeah, great question. Clients hear from us from a number of different ways, from word of mouth, referrals from local shelters, referrals from the swamped unemployment offices. For example, just north of Chicago in Evanston, Illinois, the WorkNet employees are working tirelessly at the unemployment office in Evanston, but they just don't have the capacity to sit down and help somebody, you know, format a resume or do a tedious internet job search or explore affordable housing options. So we're sort of like the safety net for a lot of these other caseworkers and employees in the cities we serve. So a lot of our clients come referred from community partners. And a lot of what we do is help people find affordable housing, whether that's Section 8, transitional housing, subsidized housing, affordable private market housing. And then employment is a huge piece of what we do, helping people search for jobs online. Nowadays, everything's internet-based, and our college students are so tech-savvy. They know all this stuff. We're helping people set up email accounts, learn how to attach resumes to email accounts, format resumes, online applications. Nowadays, it's like some of them you can't have bullets, you have to have dashes, and this is the type of expertise that our college students are bringing to the table. In addition to housing and employment, I would say helping people access public benefits that they're eligible for is a huge part of what our student advocates are doing.
In what cities is LIFT working?
Yeah, we're in 4 other major metropolitan areas: D.C., Philadelphia, New York, and Boston.
Who has done this work traditionally?
You know, that's a great question. We also have every office of ours has at least 2 site coordinators, and those site coordinators are folks who are completing terms of AmeriCorps through our partnership with the Corporation for National Service. So we also leverage the AmeriCorps members to do a lot of this work. Moving forward, traditionally, to answer your question, most of this work has been done by our student advocates from local area universities. But moving forward, we really want to try to engage anybody who's willing to jump on board and support this movement. One thing we're really doing as a team is figuring out how can we loop people in, whether it's through the direct service work, through consultation, through helping lead ongoing trainings, through other innovative partnerships at community schools, stuff like that. So we also think there's a whole realm of potential to loop in volunteers who are not just current college students. But traditionally, the model has been recruiting from campuses.
What is the most vexing challenge to moving people out of poverty?
It's a long process, you know. It's hard to expect somebody to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when they don't have boots. And especially now in this economy with more and more applicants per job opening, for example, one of the biggest challenges is just the patience and diligence it takes on behalf of our clients who are just resilient and determined and strong enough to come into our resource centers to reach out for help, but oftentimes get discouraged because finding work takes a while. That's why we try to address both immediate and long-term needs. But one of the biggest challenges is supporting people on the long term. Economic security is not something that comes easy, and it's an uphill battle for a lot of our families.
What are the most promising strategies for moving people out of poverty?
I think the job training and continuing education is a huge part of the puzzle. Helping people get entry-level positions is great, but if there's not opportunities for folks to move up the ladder and grow professionally, I think it makes a lot of sense to invest in programs and opportunities for folks to improve their skills and education so that the employment opportunities they are connecting with provide greater opportunities for growth and really kind of help more so in supporting people on their path out of poverty. I think that's a big piece of the puzzle.
Is there any low-hanging fruit here? Are there any easy solutions or easy populations to deal with?
The ones who are easier to help than others? Wow, that's a great question, one I'm not sure I have the answer to. To be honest, I think I would love to pose that question to one of our student advocates who are in the trenches every day, working with clients a lot more directly than I am on a daily basis. I think they would have some tremendous, tremendous insight there. Certainly folks who have not been formally incarcerated, it's easier to support them in finding employment. We support a lot of clients who have been formally incarcerated and have done their time and are really ready to make positive changes in their life, move forward, and maximize a second chance. But especially in this economy, it's been very challenging to support some of those clients. So I think folks who perhaps don't have criminal records are certainly fall under the answer to your question.
How do you keep your volunteers from getting frustrated? I know that sometimes the problems of the poor seem really intractable. So how do you keep people going and not frustrated?
Yeah, I think the frustration comes from what I mentioned before in seeing the frustration on clients' faces who have been doing everything in their power to make progress and move forward, who are coming in and week out to our resource centers, applying for jobs, focusing on quality over quantity in terms of resumes and job applications and really doing what they're supposed to be doing and just running into a number of challenges. It can be just sort of morale draining for both our clients and our volunteers, and it's tough to see. So we really try to support people and, you know, our volunteers and staying positive, because that's one thing we pride ourselves on in the office is just staying positive and being kind of sanctuaries of hope for folks who are really feeling pretty discouraged.
How would you characterize your volunteers? What makes a good Lyft volunteer?
Well, one thing our student advocates are phenomenal at is really tapping into people's strengths, really helping explore with our clients what their strengths are, both personally and professionally. Because the reality is a lot of folks coming into our office have some really great skills and great work experience, but they have perhaps never had to put that on a resume, or they could use some support in communicating that to potential employers. So that's one thing we're able to do there.
How does Lyft coordinate with government and the services that government offers?
Yeah, Well, one example is here in the Chicago area, Lyft is partnering with the city of Evanston, just north of Chicago, basically through the stimulus program. Lyft is being subcontracted to provide housing search and stabilization support to families affected by this crisis in Evanston. We also have a growing partnership with the Community Schools Initiative, where we've partnered with the City of Chicago Mayor's Office to experiment with some satellite services in the community schools, where we connect with parents of school children and really try to provide services to them, both in the school and then referring them to our local offices. And I think the possibilities for strengthening these partnerships with local government are just unending, and we're really looking forward to tapping into that more, because I think a public-private partnership here could yield just tremendous results. And that's really what Lyft is trying to do in the next 3 years, to increase our impact in the communities we're in, so we can really clearly demonstrate, look, we can make a sustained difference in Chicago, for example. We've proven that this model works. It's cost-effective by leveraging volunteers. Now let's take this to other cities across the country in addition to the five that we're currently in.
How do you measure your results?
We measure our results through, we have a proprietary client tracking and data gathering system where every service we provide is documented electronically. In addition to the case notes, there's hundreds of boxes that our volunteers can check, anything from help client update a resume, called landlord, applied for food stamps, applied for WIC, referred to mental health organization. And so we document all of these services rendered, and we focus on, we at Lyft firmly believe that some of those items I mentioned before, housing, employment, accessing public benefits, and then a host of other referrals services are sort of key aspects in helping somebody on their path out of poverty. So to answer your question, some of our success indicators are, did the person secure housing? Did the person secure employment? Were they able to access public benefits that they were eligible for? And then what we're going to be doing moving forward is some more intensive client tracking. Another great thing about partnering with universities is, in addition to the Lyft volunteers who are coming into our offices every week, right now in Chicago, for example, community-based research class from Loyola University, their entire semester-long project is to call every single client that Lyft Chicago has helped secure employment and housing with over the last 5 or 6 years to find out how they're doing right now. Are they still in the same housing? If not, has their housing situation improved or gotten worse? Same with the employment question. Great if we can help somebody get a job, but do they still have that job 6 months or a year later? Are they really better off in the long term? And by leveraging these tremendous relationships with our university partners, we're able to do some really great kind of further research that we don't have the capacity to necessarily do full time on our own. These college campuses, I can't say enough. Loyola University for Chicago, for example, has this Center for Experiential Learning that blows me away. Talk about walking the walk when it comes to, service learning and getting their students involved in the community. It is unbelievable. Northwestern has just started this new Center for Civic Engagement that we are just really looking forward to hopefully partnering with. And again, the possibilities of tapping into the strengths, resources from these college campuses across the country are just unending. And that's what I think the coolest part about Lyft is.
What do you do, Ben, to hang on to your volunteers?
We've determined that the greatest drivers of volunteer satisfaction are client success and office success, basically. So we really focus on supporting our volunteers with great client service skills and professional growth. So we found here in Chicago, for example, that about 85 or 90% of folks who sign up to volunteer with Lyft end up volunteering with us until they graduate, which is indicative that folks are committed. We've even experimented with service learning classes. So, for example, last semester, a Intro to Social Work class from Loyola, 15 of their students had their placement at Lyft. So they were trained just as the rest of the Lyft volunteers. And I think about 10 of those 15 students, even when they were no longer receiving credit, stuck around to volunteer with our office and are still with the organization. And in addition to just providing great support, we also offer the opportunity to grow as a volunteer. We have a two or three levels of volunteer manager positions. The highest we call student directors. So these are students who are committing, you know, 10, 15 hours a week helping with our volunteer recruitment and training, helping with our community partnerships. They have these work plans. It's like probably as much, if not more, work than one of their courses. And they get great leadership experience through these positions. And that's been really instrumental in us helping keep around this talent at Lyft offices by giving them additional responsibilities aside from just working with clients.
Ben, thanks for joining us on Smart City.
Yeah, Carol, thank you so much for this opportunity. I certainly appreciate it. If it's okay with you, can I give a quick shout out to my son who turns 1 year old this week?
Absolutely. Give a shout out to your 1 year old son.
Thank you very much. Happy birthday, Jalen. I love you. Thank you, Carol.
Ben Ruler is the executive director for Lyft Chicago. To find out more about the organization, go to smartcityradio.com where we have a link to the Lyft site. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Population growth seems to be slowing in the U.S., and many are piling the blame on the economic recession. New figures from the U.S. Census Bureau show a nationwide population growth rate of just 0.86% for the year period ending on July 1st. That's the lowest growth rate the country's seen all decade. A recent article from USA Today looks at the new census estimates, which show other seemingly recession-related anomalies in American demographics. The formerly booming states of Nevada and Florida had more people moving out than moving in, a phenomenon not seen in those places in decades. And the state of California had its fourth lowest population growth rate in more than 100 years. With fewer people moving during the recession, births are the major factor driving growth this year. And as the 2010 census approaches, many states are worried that unless growth picks back up in the coming months, they may be losing some congressional seats when the House of Representatives is reapportioned after the decennial census count in April. Meanwhile, in California, city planners and environmentalists are finding themselves in an awkward position. New rules intended to reduce carbon emissions in new developments may end up making it more difficult to build those projects with higher densities, according to an article from the New York Times. High-density development has increasingly gained popularity amongst planners looking to promote environmentally friendly development and move away from the car-dependent suburbs and exurbs that have proliferated over the last 50 years. But the new draft rules from the San Francisco Bay Area Air Quality Management District set tight limits on the allowed carbon emissions from new developments. If estimates on proposed developments go over the line, time-consuming and expensive environmental impact reports will be required. Many say that these rules, though intended to reduce the environmental impact of development, will simply disincentivize the dense urban developments planners and environmentalists have been trying to encourage. And finally, out in Detroit, where new development is almost a foreign concept, the city is seeing a new boom of investment from an unlikely source. A commercial farming company has been steadily buying up abandoned and foreclosed property within the city in hopes of developing a new urban farming operation. According to an article from the Los Angeles Times, the company has plans to buy up more than 5,000 acres of property in the city and convert it to productive farmland. But the plan is starting relatively small. The farmers will begin operation this spring with 30 acres of land. And though the land is small and scattered throughout the city, some see hope for the future of this venture in turning Detroit from a dying city into one teeming with life. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Warren Berger, author of the book Glimmer. We'll find out how thorny social problems may be solved by better design. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Design has moved far beyond million-dollar interiors and cool new typefaces. Today, it's all about a process for tackling any problem. My guest is journalist Warren Berger. He's written a book about the possibility of design called Glimmer, how design can transform your life and maybe even the world. Warren, we've done a number of programs on design, including a recent interview with IDEO's Tim Brown. We've done multiple conversations with Larry Keeley. An interview long ago with Bruce Mao, just after he launched Massive Change in Vancouver. What new information, new insights does Glimmer have for the design sophisticate?
Well, you know, really what I was trying to do with Glimmer is look at how various designers across disciplines think and solve problems and break it down as best I could into the simplest set of steps or principles that seem to be common to these designers and that maybe other people who are not designers could pick up on and apply. And that may be, you know, I'm sort of arguing in the book that we're all designers on some level. And so whether you are in business or you are in social services or whatever in your own life, you're having to design solutions to complex problems. So it makes sense to see how the best designers do that and see if you can apply some of their tools and their principles.
Where did the name for the book come from?
It came from when I was first, you know, part of what got me interested in the book was I was trying to define design for myself. You know, you see so many different definitions of design, and I started to gather definitions, and one of the ones that was intriguing to me was I came across an anonymous one on the internet that said, design is the glimmer in God's eye. And I thought that was kind of a nice way of putting it, and that word glimmer, to me, I kind of latched on to that because I think design is about seeing the possibilities and the potential. It's about seeing the glimmer of, you know, what might be a better way to do things and then developing that, trying to take that little glimmer of an idea and prototype it and finally make it something real.
And yet, by no means do you mean simply the look of things.
People tend to think of design as being the look of things and the aesthetics. And that's one of the big hurdles to overcome when you talk about design in this larger sense, because I think really what design is to me, it's creative problem solving. You know, it's about figuring out how can we make things better than they are right now. Now, sometimes there is an aesthetic component of that. You know, I mean, you may be trying to create a solution where the look of something becomes very important because you want to inspire people or you want to get people excited about something. So, you know, in the book, I talk about the design of the laptop for children in the developing world. And part of the design of that product was to make it very, very appealing looking so that kids would want to use it. So the aesthetic part can be very important. But to me, it's only a small part of what design is about. Really, when you want to think about design in the larger sense, you think about it as planning and problem solving.
You talk about the work of many designers in your book, and yet you chose to focus on one in particular, Bruce Mau, who did the very famous Massive Change exhibition on sustainability. Why did you choose to focus on Bruce and his work?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to talk across disciplines about design. I didn't want, you know, whenever people would ask me, find out I was writing a book about design, they'd say, oh, what kind? Is it an industrial design or graphic design? People tend to, separate design into all of these vertical disciplines. And one of the nice things about Bruce and a number of other designers out there is that he crosses those disciplines. He doesn't tend to think of himself as one kind of designer or another. He enters into all different types of challenges and problem-solving situations that sometimes involve graphic design or industrial design or interior design, architecture. And he will apply whatever solution is needed. So I thought he was a good example of what I wanted to talk about in the book, of design being this problem-solving way of thinking that is not limited to one discipline or another. And then the other thing about Bruce is that he just articulates the promise of design so well. He's so good at explaining to non-designers, you know, what design can do, why we should be excited about it, and what its potential is.
You use something you call the Glimmer Principles to organize the book. Describe those principles.
Well, I was looking for what it is, the common elements of what designers seem to do when they're taking on problems. And obviously, designers take on every problem differently. They work differently from each other. But I did find there were certain common elements, certain things they tend to do. And I began to refer to these in the book as these Glimmer Principles. I mean, one thing designers always seem to do is they always start the process by questioning basic assumptions, which is something the rest of us sometimes don't do. In the book, I refer to it as asking stupid questions. You know, they're the ones, designers are the ones who'll step back and say, well, just because we've done it this way for 10 or 20 or 30 years, why is it the best way? You know, why is the system operating in this way? Could it operate a different way? You know, there's a joke designers tell about one another that, you know, how many designers does it take to change a light bulb? Well, the designer will say, does it have to be a light bulb? And that's the way they tend to start out on problems. They're the person in the room who's asking these stupid questions that no one else has been asking for a very long time. The other things they do, I talk about the principle of jumping fences. They're really good at connecting ideas that seem to be unrelated and sort of thinking laterally. That's a big tool of designers. They're really good at going deep. By that, I mean studying a problem, doing close research of people and their needs, getting out there in the world and figuring out what's really needed. So those are some of the examples of the glimmer principles I refer to in the book.
You talk about stupid questions and designers being willing to ask them. You describe in the book a way of knowing used by IDEO called the 5 Whys methodology. Explain how that works and how it can influence design.
Yeah, what the 5 Whys is doing is, in a way, it's mimicking what a very young child will do, which is every time you answer a question, the child will ask why again. And IDEO and others adopt this approach in their business, whereby when you're trying to solve a problem, as you come up with each answer, you ask why. Why that answer? And so what you're doing is you're kind of analyzing all the assumptions that are made. And it becomes really important to do that because, you know, we tend to take certain things at face value because it's the existing way of doing things. And the designer, by constantly asking why, you know, well, why does it have to have 4 wheels? You know, why does the car have to run on gas? By doing that, they are constantly challenging the assumptions. And this actually opens the door to new possibilities. You know, you find that when you ask those, so many of the cases in the book that I point to and the stories that I tell start with somebody asking why and then asking why again. You know, Dean Kamen, one of the designers in the book, happened to be out and noticed that a person in a wheelchair was unable to get their wheelchair over a curb. And he just was asking why. In this day and age, why can't someone in a wheelchair get over a curb and climb steps? This became the beginning of his designing a wheelchair that could climb over a curb and climb steps. There were so many examples of that through the book of the why being the starting point.
Don Norman of Nielsen Norman, also at Northwestern, is another designer whose work you cite, along with his 3 levels of design appeal. The 3 levels he defines are visceral, behavioral, and reflective. Explain how we respond to these levels of design, and particularly the reflective design.
The visceral level is kind of the impact that design has on you when you first see it. And oftentimes something is very sleek. If we take an example, one of Apple's wonderful products, an iPod or an iPhone. You know, what may first have its impact on you is the visceral impact. You see this object that looks very sleek and you just sort of want to hold it and you want to touch it. And that's operating on a visceral level. Now, on the behavioral level, there's a sort of functional level that happens where you want to figure out if you can master this particular object, if you can use it comfortably and easily. And that is sort of becomes the second level. And once you can master that, then you move to the higher level where you think about this object in terms of, well, what does this do for me and my identity? And is this something that I want to be associated with? Is this something that when people see me using it, they'll think higher of me? Is it something I'll want to tell my friends about? And this is the highest level of design appeal. And Apple connects on this one as well because everyone wants to be part of the Apple Club. Everyone wants to be seen as being, you know, sort of smart and with it. And they have Apple products and they can show off the newest product to their friends. So those are sort of 3 levels that design tends to work on.
To what extent, Warren, do you think that advertising still plays a strong role in that reflective level. In other words, what this does for my identity, what this product or experience does for my identity.
I still think advertising plays a very big role in creating that part of a product's appeal, the identity and what it does for you. But there's an interesting change going on. And in the book, I actually say that I think design is the new advertising. Because there's a funny thing happening now where the experience of using a product, it's so important now that you get that right. And that involves good design. And the reason it's more important than ever is because people talk to each other more than ever now because of social networking and the internet and Facebook and what have you, and Amazon, people doing their own reviews on Amazon. So what happens is you're not as dependent on sales pitches and slogans and advertising to get you information anymore. Now you're kind of getting it a lot from your peers. And what your peers are giving you is not a slogan or a sales pitch. They're giving you the truth of the experience as they experienced it. You know, they're telling you how well this product or this service really works. And so in a funny way now, you know, design is the new advertising. You almost, if you can get that experience right and you can design something that's really great, it almost is better than advertising because it will become a word of mouth phenomenon in the social networks now that can really drive your business.
You give examples of marketing campaigns that, as you put it, don't shout at people, but instead surround them. And you quote Bruce Mao as saying, "It's a wonder that advertising still exists." He calls for, and you seem to support, eliminating the interruption associated with advertising and increasing the relevance. How do you do that?
Well, it's a complicated thing. I mean, basically, what Bruce is saying is that a company should design its behaviors and its activities so that everywhere you look, you're seeing something good that that company is doing. And if they can succeed in doing that, they will no longer have to interrupt your television shows to tell you how great they are, because you will begin to admire them every time you go into their store, because you'll see how wonderful their store is designed, or you'll begin to admire them because you see they're involved in various social programs, or they are doing something for your community that you really like, or they're sponsoring something that you think is really cool. So by doing that, by designing that kind of corporate behavior, you more or less create an identity that people come in contact with all the time, and it lessens the need for you to shout at people about how great you are. They will kind of come to that conclusion on their own, which is much, much better, much more convincing.
Early in the book, you have this great sidebar on Bruce's work in his hometown of Sudbury, a mining town in northern Canada. I had a brief opportunity to work with Bruce on this project. Retell that story.
Well, it's interesting. Bruce grew up in Sudbury, and he describes it as kind of a harsh, cold mining town that, hasn't changed in years. And he was just dying to get out of it as a young person. And he left and, you know, went on to the big city and had a great career. And then many years later, you know, came in contact with the Chamber of Commerce or people at that town and started a discussion about whether some of the things he does, which is to advise large groups and even cities and organizations on design, whether that could be applicable to a town like Sudbury. One of the things he showed them right off the bat was that basic things had not changed there. You know, they hadn't changed the way an intersection looked in town. Everything was sort of gray concrete and dreary. What he said to them is the way you design your town or your city, simple things like the way it looks and how modern it is, whether you've updated things, whether you've kept up with the times, this sends an important signal to the people living there, especially the young people. It tells them either there's a future here or there isn't. And if they feel that this is a dead-end town where nothing has changed, nothing has been updated, nothing has been beautified in many, many years, it says to them, I better get out of here when I reach a certain age. I better move on. And that was kind of his point to them. And now he's working with a committee and working with the town to try to figure out how they can redesign that whole town. And he's very interested in taking advantage of the town's natural assets. It's actually a town that has beautiful lakes and parks and hasn't quite designed access to these things very well. So it's not utilizing some of its natural resources. And so he's trying to get them to think in terms of doing all of that.
You tell another story about Bruce that I find very instructive. It's about the potential fertility of the period that a designer or anyone goes through in problem solving, that period of not knowing. Describe that.
Yeah, what Bruce found as he was, you know, setting up his design firm was that there's a period when you're first taking on a challenge or a problem where you don't have very much information. You haven't done all of your homework yet. You haven't done all of your research. You haven't talked to all the experts. A lot of people try to get past that period immediately. They feel that that period has no value because you don't know anything. And so they immediately immerse themselves in expertise, research, conventional wisdom. In other words, they do tons and tons of homework. And then they start to think in terms of finding solutions to the problem. And what Bruce found is that there's an interesting thing that happens in that small window before you do all that homework, when you don't know much of anything about the situation. There's a nice period there for random thinking and experimental ideas with just a little bit of information. The value of that is you're not steeped in the expertise and the conventional wisdom that tells you what you can't do. As you start to talk to experts and as you start to learn about a problem, you immediately get told all the things that can't be done or that don't make sense. And the fact is, oftentimes, there are great ideas that defy that conventional wisdom. And it involves someone coming in with a fresh perspective and with basically a lack of knowledge and beginning to play with some crazy ideas early on. So Bruce's thinking is that, you know, you use that period of not knowing to come up with some very early ideas. Those ideas may or may not go anywhere, but they give you some sort of wild things to start with. And then you begin to do your research and you figure out if those ideas really have any practicality, whether they can really work or not. But that period of not knowing is actually just a great, great little pocket of a little opportunity to look at some very, very unusual offbeat ideas.
You know, I find that the not knowing period actually paralyzes most people. Most people are scrambling for best practices. They want to know who's already solved the problem before they make a move. Do you know what separates those people who revel in not knowing and get motivated by that from those who simply get paralyzed?
I think anyone can adopt to this other way of thinking where you feel comfortable. They're probably just not used to it. It has to do with the way we are schooled, I think. You know, we're kind of, one design expert told me that, you know, he feels that when we go through school, we are told you never present anything to anyone until you've done a tremendous amount of research and until you've honed it, until you've rewritten it 20 times and you feel that it's perfect, and then you turn it in and you try to get an A. Okay, this is the way we're conditioned, and it carries into the workplace. What designers feel is that you don't approach problems that way. You know, you approach problems in a way that is much more experimental. You tend to come up with answers in a step-by-step way, and you show them to people sometimes when they're not done. You know, you show ideas and prototypes to people when they're in rough form, you know, knowing that you're going to get some knocks for it, but you can learn from that. So it's actually a different approach to solving problems that I think any of us can learn, but we have to step back from the old model, which says, you know, which follows a certain process of always doing a lot of research, always trying to perfect things, always keeping your ideas to yourself until the very end and then sharing them. It's a different model. And I think it makes a lot of sense because what it does is it allows you to, number one, consider a lot of ideas that haven't been considered, but then it also allows you to begin to solve problems in a step-by-step way where you're not afraid of failing. You know, the great thing about designers is they're not afraid of failure because they've incorporated failure into the design process. It's a step in the process where you create a prototype and it fails, but you learn from the failure and then you do version 2.0, version 3.0.
You've already alluded to the fact that Bruce has suggested that we reinvent corporate social responsibility. We reinvent corporate marketing, and we do that in some ways by reinventing corporate social responsibility. And then you talk also in the book about designers and their own social responsibility. How are today's designers sort of rethinking their own responsibility to the larger world rather than simply to the client?
Well, I think it's become a big issue. You know, designers have a little bit of a guilty conscience, I think, because they know that over the years, they were designing a lot of stuff. You know, they were designing a lot of objects, and they were designing a lot of things that were disposable, but maybe not as disposable as we'd like to think. They ended up in landfills. And so designers now are sort of stepping back, a lot of them anyway, and they're saying, gee, you know, what responsibility do I have if I'm bringing objects and creations into the world? You know, what responsibility do I have to make sure those objects and creations don't, you know, contaminate the world, and that they have a life that that lasts, and that maybe they have a second life that they can be reborn into. So this has become part of the mindset of more and more designers. And it's something that, you know, they have to now factor into the design process in terms of the materials they use and the way they construct products. And they have to ask those stupid questions now, like, what happens after this product is done being used? You know, what becomes of it? And that now has to become part of the design process too. You not only think about the initial use of the product, but you think about what is going to happen to this thing later on when people are done using it. Now, the nice thing is that as designers are beginning to think this way, their clients are too, and not just out of the goodness of their hearts. You know, more and more companies are being forced by consumers to be more responsible. They're being held to account in their behavior. And so now companies, when they hire designers, have to be aware of this stuff, and it has some value now.
Warren, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Pleasure being here.
Warren Berger is a journalist and author. His book is called Glimmer: How Design Can Transform Your Life and Maybe Even the World. Finally, here are some closing thoughts for Smart Cities from our City Views commentator, Walker Smith.
There was a bit of poignancy to our family celebration this past Thanksgiving. For many years now, decades in fact, my sisters and I, along with our families, have driven to Columbia, South Carolina every Thanksgiving morning to celebrate a late afternoon Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house. Grapefruit salad with avocado and pomegranate seeds, shrimp cocktail, turkey, white or dark, oyster casserole, sweet potato casserole, dressing with and without onions, crescent rolls, yellow rice for Anise, homemade slaw for me with and without onions, cranberry sauce, cranberry jelly, caramel cake, sherbet, and noisemakers with a prize inside. My dad would carve the bird, and my mother would always dally in the kitchen long after the rest of us had dug in. It was a ritual. We each had our parts. It was something to count on every year. It has become so much of a tradition that we organize every aspect of our holidays around it. The day after, my oldest sister wades into the Black Friday crowds with her daughters, while her husband hustles back home at the crack of dawn to open his furniture store to his own crowds. By mid-afternoon Friday, my two sisters and I always wind up in the aisles of the happy bookseller, filling our arms with books. That night, we eat leftovers with our parents and then head our separate ways on Saturday or Sunday. Something like this has been a yearly happening for so long that I can barely remember what Thanksgiving was like when we didn't do it. But now it's coming to an end. The happy bookseller closed a couple of years ago, and my parents no longer have the physical fortitude it takes to put together the kind of spread they always used to lay out on the sideboard of the dining room. My oldest niece is newly engaged, and for the last few years, my wife has spent the entire Thanksgiving weekend with her extended family as her mom's health has faded. There will come a day soon when our tradition will be a memory. All good things, as the saying goes. These city views have been like a tradition to me as well. I had never met Carol when she called me out of the blue in the fall of 2001 to ask if I would have an interest in doing a weekly commentary about consumer trends for her new, rapidly growing show. So in November 2001, I began this weekly ritual of recording some brief thoughts to close her wonderful show. At first, I did talk about trends, but I realized early on that the best way I knew to reflect on the meaning of these bigger dynamics was to make a connection with something personal in my life. So my commentaries have become personal, an indulgence that you, the listeners of Carol's show, have afforded me. It is a weekly ritual that has helped me grow and learn for the past 8 years. Carol took a chance on me those many years ago. I had never done anything like this before. She entrusted me with the responsibility to be honest and insightful and thought-provoking. I've had to learn along the way, and I haven't always lived up to the challenge. But I have found comfort and inspiration in the ritual of worrying over these commentaries each week. And what I think I have learned most in looking back on it is that it's not the ritual itself that has value, but what you take from it, and what stays with you long after the ritual is gone. For me, the value of City Views has been less the substance of what I've said and more the process of making myself think and write about things that matter, at least to me. In a way, it's the same with Thanksgiving. Looking back years from now, my sisters and I and our families will look back with nostalgia on the ways in which we used to celebrate. We'll miss it. But more than that, we will still be carrying with us the ways in which we learn to appreciate and care for one another around my parents' dinner table. Thank you, Carol, for giving me the same opportunity to take something with me. The discipline of City Views has helped me understand myself more clearly and has enabled me to come across new ideas and insights. And I hope this has been valuable to all of you, you listeners, as well. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. There's more Smart City for you online, and there always will be. Go to smartcityradio.com to download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered straight to you. We're pleased to continue bringing you Smart City as a web exclusive. You can hear uncut and extended interviews and even some video content coming soon. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.